the learning today. It'll be Lili Nishmat in memory of and for the merit of Yitzchak ben Eliezer. Keep that in mind. Last week, we started our discussion of whether Judaism believes in intelligent extraterrestrial life by looking at different ways to frame the question. We talked about the Drake equation, we talked about a variety of things, but then we brought it specifically to the debate about anthropocentrism and the question of whether human beings are meant to be, as far as Judaism is concerned, the point of the entire universe, such that I might argue that there can't be intelligent extraterrestrials elsewhere because we are supposed to be the focus. So we talked about some sources that could seem to support the idea that, in fact, yes, we are supposed to be of central importance, and even the angels, these malachim, which are intelligent, non-human entities, are really about us, and their focus is on human beings. And we said that was the view of Rav Sadia Gaon. For a range of reasons, he said human beings are of primary importance. Our mitzvot are important, our free will is important, and that was his view. Now, that view makes it hard to believe in intelligent life elsewhere, especially if they have more advanced technology, but it's not impossible, because you could still make the argument that just like there are creatures on Earth which have traits that are superior to our own, they can hear better, they can run faster, they can see things we can't see, and so on, so too, there could be beings out there who have abilities and traits that we don't know about and that they will, connect with us in some way, and we could still be as important as we are, even with intelligent life elsewhere. That was all one view. The other view was that no, human beings are not the sole purpose. We pointed out that malachim, angels, seem to be depicted by the rabbis in various midrashim as having some level of free will and some sense of morality of their own. And we said, it's unclear that those midrashim are meant to be taken literally, and we're not going to re-explore those, but they are out there. We also pointed out God's speech to Job at the end of the book of Job, where he says, human beings don't know a whole lot about the universe, and we are not the sole focus of the world that God created. And that really seems to support the idea that no, there's a lot out there that isn't human, and it isn't about us. And where we left off, I wanted to show you the view of Maimonides, who is definitely in this camp that says that we are not the be-all and end-all of everything. And then once we've done that, I want to move into showing some classic Jewish texts which indicate what our sages believed one way or the other in this issue. And we'll bring some more sources that will cast some light on the anthropocentricity debate. So we have a lot to talk about. Okay? So far so good? Okay. So, Maimonides. A little bit of an orientation for anyone who's not up on his biography. He was born in the year 1135, passed away in the year 1204 approximately. He's born in Muslim Spain, where his father was a rabbi and a communal leader. He was persecuted by the Almohads, who were a Muslim empire. The family fled from Spain. It ultimately arrived in Morocco. And then there was persecution in Morocco. They went on. They went to Akko in Israel. They toured Israel a little bit. But the Jewish community there had been devastated by the Crusades. And they left Israel and they went to Egypt. And there, Rambam Maimonides becomes leader of the Egyptian Jewish community. He has an interesting political role that people don't talk about that much, but he was involved in getting Jewish hostages of the Crusaders freed. He is invited to become the physician for Saladin's family and ends up spending a lot of his time in medicine. And he writes on basically anything and everything in Judaism, Jewish thought, Jewish law. He has something to say about basically everything one way or another, whether he wrote a full commentary on it and a full text on it or not. He seems to have He knew everything, and he categorized everything. He organized everything. It's really, really a remarkable overarching figure. So what I want to show you in source number one on the sheet is his view of the role of human beings. And essentially what he says is human beings are the purpose of the earthly plane of existence, but that plane is only part of a larger cosmology. So he says, those who hold this view, namely that the existence of man is the object of the whole creation, if you really believe that everything God created revolves around us, so then you may be asked whether God could have created man without those previous creations, or whether man could only have come into existence after the creation of all other things. If you believe that we are the center of everything, then that means that in order for human beings to exist, there have to be moths and scorpions and African tree frogs and whatever else, because they exist in order for us to exist. So that means that they are somehow necessary for us. So he says, if they answer in the affirmative, that man could have been created even if, e.g., the heavens did not exist. He says, if you would make the argument that no, we don't, those things aren't necessary for the existence of human beings, then they'll be asked, what is the object of all these things, since they do not exist for their own sake, but for the sake of something that could exist without them? He says, you can't have it both ways. Either we are the point, in which case we couldn't exist without all the things that God created in the universe, or alternatively, we could exist without those things, but then why are they there? Now, the truth of the matter is, he's cheating a little bit. Because you could argue that there are things that God creates that are beneficial without being necessities. You could make that argument. But he's painting it as a binary picture. That everything that exists must either be a necessity for human beings, or it's superfluous. So he says, we who believe in the creation must admit that God could have created the universe in a different manner as regards the causes and effects contained in it. God could have created the universe any way God chose. And this would lead to the absurd conclusion that everything except man existed without any purpose. As the principal object, man could have been brought into existence without the rest of the creation. He says, you're telling me that we need African tree frogs in order for there to be human beings, but God can create whatever God wants. So why didn't God create us without that? Why are they here at all? So the Rambam, Maimonides, says, I consider therefore the following opinion as most correct according to the teaching of the Bible and best in accordance with the results of philosophy. Namely, the universe does not exist for man's sake, but that each being exists for its own sake and not because of some other thing. We're here and they're here. We have purposes. They have a purpose. And the truth is, I began by saying that he believes that we are the purpose of the earthly plane, but he didn't even say that here, right? Here he's saying that even the things on the earthly plane may exist for another function. Unless he's referring to, I'm not sure of that. But that's Maimonides' position. And so, as far as he is concerned, and I brought you source number two as well along the same lines, but I think I'm going to skip it in the interests of time. You know what? No, I won't skip it. I remember now what this adds. This adds something important. Take a look at number two. He says, the object of the spheres, when he says the spheres, he's thinking about that cosmology that they believed where there's the earth in the middle and then you have successive spheres around it that the sun and the moon and the stars are all anchored in. So he says, the object of the spheres may be the continuance of successive genesis and destruction. And the succession of genesis and destruction serves, as has already been said, to give existence to mankind. This idea of creation and destruction and cycles of it in the universe exists in order to make sure that we can exist. This idea is supported by biblical texts and sayings of our sages. But the philosopher replies thus, if the difference between the heavenly bodies and the transient individual members of the species consisted in their different sizes, this opinion could be maintained. but as the different consists in their essence, it remains improbable that the superior beings should be the means of giving existence to the lower ones. Maimonides is of the belief that the angels out there are superior to us in their knowledge of God and in their powers, what they were able to do. So he says, would it make sense that God creates such superior entities for our sake? That's the argument that he adds there. So he believes that there are different realms of creation. And we are occupying one realm, and we have a key role to play in that realm. And the other things exist for their own purpose. Clear? I mean, as clear as anything involving spheres and angels is going to be. Yes, Nurit.
So according to Maimonides, what is the role of human beings?
Good. So. As far as he is concerned, our role is to fulfill our mitzvot, our commandments, to live the life that God wants us to live, to gain knowledge of God and draw close to God, to perform acts of kindness to others. That's why we're here. But not that we are the only reason the universe exists. That's why we exist. We have a role to play. God told us what he wants us to do. Maimonides is very slanted towards the intellectual in general, and understanding God is very, very important to him as part of the goal of what we're here for. That's his way of looking at it. If you were to look at number three, I'm not going to read it out in at length, but Maimonides talks about, and this is in his Mishneh Torah, which is his work of law, he talks about how the universe has three different parts to it. You have creatures which are composites of matter and form. Matter and form you may be familiar with as Greek ideas. Matter being substance and form being the purpose of that substance, which dictates its characteristics. So you have beings like us that are made up of matter and form, purpose, design, meaning. And we come into existence, we are destroyed continually. Then on the other hand, you have creatures that are also composites of matter and form. However, they don't change the way we do. Their form is fixed. And that he's referring to the spheres and the stars and the like. Of course, we understand stars in a way that's different from the way he did. But that's his understanding. And then he has a third. Creatures that just have purpose, but don't have any matter to them. And those are the malachim, the angels. And each one has its own realm and has its own function. And if you will ask, what's the point of having these celestial beings? What is the reason for their existence? Take a look at source number four, where he writes, all of the stars and spheres have spirits and intellect and mind. They are alive and enduring, and they recognize the one who spoke and the world came into existence. They recognize God. Each of them, according to its size and according to its stature, praises and glorifies their creator like the malachim. And just as they recognize God, so they recognize themselves and recognize the malachim above them. And the intellect of the stars and spheres is smaller than that of the malachim and greater than that of human beings. They all have their own function and their own role and their own relationship with God. Don't assume that they are here because we are here. Clear? I mean, again, as clear as anything involving angels and intelligent stars is going to be. But, you know, we're working with what we have. So all of this that we've said regarding the view of Maimonides really makes it sound like human beings are not the essence, right? That's what you're getting away from, that's what we're getting from all of this. However, I have to clarify something here, lest I paint Maimonides with too black and white a brush. If anybody downloaded the source sheet in the first like half an hour after I sent it out on Monday, so you don't have the following source probably. Because it took me a minute to update this. I only thought about it after I had sent that out. So source number 5 on your sheet should now be Jeremiah 33:25. Does anyone not have that? Okay. So anyone who doesn't have that, I'm going to read it out loud. You'll be okay. But all your future sources that I'm going to be using will be one off, because I added it after I had, it was like half an hour, 40 minutes later, but some of you are just too quick. So this is a verse. It's Jeremiah chapter 33, sentence 25. God says, "If not for my covenant day and night, I would not have put in place the laws of heaven and earth." Which means, on a very simple and straightforward level, God says, I wouldn't have created the universe if not for my covenant. What do we think of as God's covenant? What does that mean? The Torah, right? That's the way it's usually understood, is that it's a reference to the Torah, and it's making a statement, and that's the way at least one passage in the Talmud reads it. It's making a statement that Torah study, day and night, is what causes God to keep the universe going. Maimonides takes it slightly differently. In his Laws of Circumcision, he understands the covenant to be specifically a reference to Brit Milah, to circumcision. And he says that's the value of circumcision, is its importance is such that God says, if not for my Brit, my covenant, I would not have created the universe. So Maimonides quotes this as a statement of law in his law book. So he does believe that we are vital. That doesn't mean we are the only purpose, and that doesn't mean that the Malachim exist for us, but it does mean he believes that we are of crucial importance. Do you understand the difference? You follow? We can be vital without everything existing only to serve us or to serve our needs. Yes, Nurit.
So if that is the case, we are going back to that we are the center of the universe.
So I don't I don't think you have to say that. I think what he could be saying is we are necessary. But that doesn't mean that everything that exists exists because it relates to us. It just means that without us, they wouldn't be there. Effectively, it could be argued, we exist for their sake. We exist in order to maintain the covenant so that they can exist. Maybe you could turn it on its head. You see? Do you see what I'm saying? Kind of. Let me see if I can reframe what I'm thinking here. I'm going to use a sports analogy because that's where my head naturally goes. Okay, you have a hockey team. Since we're Canadians here, we have some non-Canadians I think who are listening on to the recordings. But looking around, I think the room is Canadian currently. So you have in hockey various rules that are necessary in order for the game to be a good game. If you take away those rules, the game is not going to be fun. So for example, a team is not able to place all of its players in front of the goal so that nobody can score. And they can't place all of their players at the other end in front of the other goal either so that the other goalie can't function. Why? Because the game won't be fun if you don't have those rules. So those rules become necessary. However, the game doesn't exist for the sake of those rules. The rules exist for the sake of the game. So what I'm arguing is, the analogy is not perfect, I'm doing what I can on the spot, but the argument that I think you can make in terms of Maimonides is he's not contradicting himself. He believes that it is necessary for the function of the universe for there to be people who are honoring the covenant with God, whether that is learning Torah or whether that's circumcision, whatever covenant means. However, God has multiple things he wants to have exist in this universe that we are powering. Powering is a good example. Batteries are really, really important for devices to function. However, they're not the reason you have it. I don't have a laptop in order to have a laptop battery. but I need the laptop battery or else this laptop wouldn't function because it's not plugged in. So, you know, that's the way I'm looking at it. Moish, what were you going to say? You're muted. Moish, you're still muted. Well, you're not muted, but I still can't hear you. I don't know. Sorry. Okay. Yes, Abe, were you going to say something? No, Ricky, were you going to say? Were you going to say something?
When you quoted with the Yahushiel, was that what my mind is basing his theory, or is this just an intellectual working out?
No, Yirmiyahu was what I quoted. Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah. So what I quoted from Yirmiyahu was just a statement which Maimonides accepts, that there is a human activity that is necessary in order for the universe to function.
No, I mean, is there another basis in the Torah? What is Maimonides basing?
On what? When you say, what is he basing himself on? Which idea of his are you talking about?
Well, the idea of our place in the universe and where what's necessary or not, is that based on something in the Torah?
Yeah, no, So he's basing all of it on verses, Talmudic ideas, as well as philosophy. All of the above. He lays out his logic for you in sources like what I brought you in 1, 2, and 3. 1, 2, 3, and 4, I should say. Some of it is easily recognizable as traceable to a particular passage, and some of it really is not. The knock on Maimonides has always been, since his own day, that he didn't like to present his sources. He told you his idea, but he very often, in philosophy, he does sometimes tell you, this is from this text here, and this is from that passage there. In law, he doesn't, as a general principle, bring his sources, and there are those who really criticized him for it. Okay, so what we're saying at this point is, from a philosophy perspective, you've got the view that we are the center of everything, everything is here for us to take care of our needs, to make sure we can thrive and succeed. You have the view that says there's a lot going on in this universe that has nothing to do with human beings, which doesn't take away from the idea that we may be vital for the existence of the universe. So if you come back to the extraterrestrial question, there could be intelligent extraterrestrial life off somewhere in the universe that doesn't know about us, that doesn't interact with us, that exists because of us, in the sense that we enable their existence. But that doesn't mean that they're going to interact with us at any point. It doesn't mean that they're there for us. They have some other reason to exist. Sylvia.
Yeah, I just have one question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I just have one question. God created the heaven and the earth before we made a covenant.
Yes. So this is actually a very interesting point that I skipped last week. I mentioned it, but I didn't go into it. Do you remember the text where the angels are complaining about giving us the Torah? And they said, you had this Torah with you for 974 generations, right? Do you remember that? And I said, don't worry about the 974 generations. So what it's talking about is there's a verse in Psalms which goes, Davar tziva le'elef dor, that God issued a command to 1,000 generations, or at the 1,000th generation, is the way the sages understand it, which teaches that there are 1,000 generations from the time God creates the Torah until he gives it to humanity. Now, if you count the generations, the begats, from Adam and Eve all the way until Sinai, you only get 26 generations. So that means there are 974 before Adam and Eve. What that means, what the generations before the world is created, is a very good question. But that's where that came from, the 974. I'm mentioning that just in terms of your question. So what's the deal? Where, you know, God creates things before there's ever a covenant. So first of all, if I take covenant to mean what Rambam thinks it means, which is circumcision, So that happens relatively early on in the time of Abraham and Sarah. If I take it as the giving of the Torah, so it's another few generations after that. But there is a line which the sages teach, which actually hung in my classroom when I was a kid in school, but they didn't explain it fully. The line goes, Hebrew speakers may be familiar with this. It goes, Derech Eretz Kadma La Torah. Anyone ever hear that line? Derech Eretz Kadma La Torah? So what it means, I see Sarah shaking her head, yes? Derech Eretz means the way of the world, the way the world functions, society. So people usually translate that line to mean respectful interaction with others precedes the Torah, comes before the Torah. What the line actually means is what Sylvia was asking about, because the full line is Derech Eretz Kadma La Torah, human society, respectful, positive interaction precedes the Torah, because God waited 26 generations before giving us the Torah. In other words, God waited for 26 generations before giving the Torah at Sinai because he wanted us to learn how to play nicely together first. And even though having this covenant, as you mentioned, Sylvia, was so vital that God wanted it there from the beginning, he said, I can't. They have to learn how to build a society first. And so he gave us time to try to learn to do that before giving us the Torah. Whether that means that by Sinai we had actually learned the lesson and built a society, or God just gave up waiting, is a good question. But that's the idea. Coupled with the idea that there have always been, from the beginning, people who were close to God, had a relationship with God, and therefore were involved in Torah on some level, which is a big idea in its own right. But I hope that addresses your question. Excuse me.
Thank you.
Sure. Excuse me. All right, Rose.
How do you define a generation?
Right, so I'm not going there. The whole thing about the 974, I don't want to go there. Ricky.
So is Abraham the first Jew, or did the people who stood at Sinai are
the first Jews? That is a classic question for which there is no true answer. The answer depends on how you define who is a Jew. But it's a good question. Okay, so this is all philosophy. What we want to do now is to change over to talk about what Jewish text has said when addressing this question directly. I'm actually going to create a new recording.